Chapter 9. Meat. I believe that the great American hamburger is a thing of beauty, its simple charms noble, pristine. The basic recipe, ground beef, salt and pepper, formed into a patty, grilled or seared on a griddle, then nestled between two halves of a bun, usually but not necessarily accompanied by lettuce, a tomato slice, and some ketchup, is to my mind unimprovable by man or God. A good burger can be made more complicated, even more interesting, by the addition of other ingredients, like good cheese or bacon, relish perhaps, but it will never be made better. I like a blue cheeseburger as much as the next guy, when I'm in the mood for blue cheese. But if it's a burger I want, I stick to the classics, meat and bun. I believe this to be the best way to eat a hamburger. I believe that the human animal evolved as it did, with eyes in the front of its head, long legs, fingernails, eye teeth, so that it could better chase down slower, stupider creatures, kill them, and eat them. That we are designed to find and eat meat, and only became better as a species when we learned to cook it. We are not, however, designed to eat shit, or fecal coliform bacteria, as it's slightly more obliquely referred to after an outbreak. Tens of thousands of people are made sick every year by the stuff. Some have died horribly. Shit happens, right? Literally, it turns out. That's pretty much what I thought anyway, until I read recent news accounts of a particularly destructive outbreak of the pathogen 015787. What I came away with was a sense of disbelief, outrage, and horror. Not so much at the fact that a deadly strain of E. coli found its way into our food supply and made people sick, but at the way other, presumably healthy burgers are made, the ones that didn't make anybody sick. I was well aware, I mean, I assumed, that your frozen, pre-made burger patty, the one intended for institutional or low-end fast food use, your slender and cheap pre-packaged supermarket disc, was not of the best quality cuts. But when I read in the New York Times that as standard practice, when making their American Chef's Selection Angus beef patties, the food giant Cargill's recipe for hamburger consisted of, among other things, quote, a mix of slaughterhouse trimmings and a mash-like product derived from scraps, unquote, and that the ingredients came from slaughterhouses in Nebraska, Texas, and Uruguay, and from a South Dakota company that processes fatty trimmings and treats them with ammonia to kill bacteria, well, I was surprised. By the end of the article, I came away with more faith in the people who process cocaine on jungle tarpaulins, or the anonymous but hard-working folks in their underwear and goggles who cut inner-city smack, than I had in the meat industry. I was no less carnivorous, but my faith had been seriously damaged. A central tenet of my belief system, that meat, even lesser-quality meat, was essentially a good thing, was shaken. Call me crazy, call me idealistic, but you know what I believe? I believe that when you're making hamburger for human consumption, you should at no time deem it necessary or desirable to treat its ingredients in ammonia, or any cleaning product for that matter. I don't think that's asking a lot, and I don't ask a lot for my fellow burger eaters, only that whatever it is that you're putting in my hamburger, that laid out on a table or cutting board prior to grinding, it at least resembles something that your average American might recognize as meat. Recall, please, that this is me talking. I've eaten the extremities of feculent southern warthog, every variety of gut, ear, and snout of bushmeat. I've eaten raw seal, guinea pig. I've eaten bat. In every case, they were at least identifiable as coming from an animal. Closer, even at their worst, to taste like chicken than space-age polymer. An enormous percentage of burger meat in this country now contains scraps from the outer part of the animal that were once deemed sufficiently safe only for pet food. But now, thanks to a miracle process pioneered by a company that warms the trimmings, removes the fat in a centrifuge, and treats the remaining product with ammonia, we don't have to waste perfectly good beef on Fluffy or Boots. An amalgam of meat from different slaughterhouses is how the Times describes what's for dinner when you dig into American Chef Selection Angus beef patties. But what the fuck does that mean? Meat industry spokesmen, when rushed to television studios to counter the blowback from the latest incident of E. coli-related illness, usually respond with expressions of sympathy for the victims, assurances that our meat supply is safer than ever, and the kind of measured, reasonable noises that go over well when faced with hyperbolic arguments against meat in general. But they are very cautious when pressed on the specifics, When asked to describe the kind of scraps used in a particular brand of hamburger, they will invariably describe the trimmings as coming from premium cuts like sirloin, rib, and tenderloin, which is, of course, technically true. But what parts of those cuts? Sirloin and rib sections and primal cuts sound pretty good, but what we're largely talking about here is the fatty, exposed outer edges that are far more likely to have come in contact with air, crap-smeared hides, other animals, and potential contaminants. The better question might be, please tell me which of these scraps you would have been unable to use a few years ago, and exactly what do you have to do to them to make them what you would consider safe? In another telling anomaly of the meat-grinding business, many of the larger slaughterhouses will sell their product only to grinders who agree to not test their product for E. coli contamination until after it's run through the grinder with a whole bunch of other meat from other sources. Meaning, the company who grinds all that shit together before selling it to your school system often can't test it until after they mix it with meat they bought from other, sometimes as many as three or four, slaughterhouses. It's the who-me strategy. The idea is simply that these slaughterhouses don't want to know, because if they find out something's wrong, they might have to actually do something about it and be, like, accountable for this shit, recall all the product they sold to other vendors. It's like demanding of a date that she have unprotected sex with four or five other guys immediately before sleeping with you, just so she can't point the finger directly at you should she later test positive for clap. To my way of thinking, before you slip into the hot tub at the Playboy Mansion is probably when your companions would like you to be tested, not after. It should be pointed out, I guess, that McDonald's and most other fast food retailers test the finished products far more frequently than the people who sell the stuff to them, and much more aggressively than school systems, which, while admirable, or at least judicious on their part, seems somehow wrong. Meat industry flacks point to the tiny percentage of their products that end up having to be recalled or turn out to be problematic. But we eat a lot of beef in this country. However small that percentage, that's still a lot of fucking hamburger. I don't want to sound like Eric Schlosser or anything. I'm hardly an advocate for better, cleaner, healthier, or more humane. But you know what? This Cargill outfit is the largest private company in America. $116 billion in revenue a year. And they feel the need to save a few cents on their low-end burgers by buying shit processed in ammonia? Scraps that have to be whipped or extracted or winnowed out or rendered before they can put them into a patty mix? Mystery meat assembled from all over the world and put through one grinder, like one big group grope in moist body temperature sheets with strangers? I believe that as an American, I should be able to walk into any restaurant in America and order my hamburger, that most American of foods, medium fucking rare. I don't believe my hamburger should have to come with a warning to cook it well done to kill off any potential contaminants or bacteria. I believe I shouldn't have to be advised to thoroughly clean and wash up immediately after preparing a hamburger. I believe I should be able to treat my hamburger like food, not like infectious fucking medical waste. I believe the words meat and treated with ammonia should never occur in the same paragraph, much less the same sentence, unless you're talking about surreptitiously disposing of a corpse. This is not Michael Pollan talking to you right now, or Eric Schlosser, whose zeal on this subject is well documented. I don't, for instance, feel the same way about that other great American staple, the hot dog. With the hot dog, there was always a feeling of implied consent. We always knew or assumed that whatever it was inside that snappy tube, it might contain anything, from 100% kosher beef to dead zoo animals or parts of missing Gambino family. With a hot dog, especially New York's famous Dirty Water hot dog, there was a tacit agreement that you were on your own. They were pre-cooked anyway, so how bad could it be? The hamburger is different. It's a more intimate relationship. Unlike the pre-cooked German import, the hot dog, the hamburger, or ground beef, has been embraced as an expression of our national identity. The backyard barbecue, mom's meatloaf, these are American traditions, rites of passage. Is it too much to feel that it should be a basic right that one can cook and eat a hamburger without fear? To stand proud in my backyard, if I had a backyard, grilling a nice medium-rare fucking hamburger for my kid without worrying that maybe I'm feeding her a shit sandwich? That I not feel the need to cross-examine my mother should she have the temerity to offer my child meatloaf? I shouldn't have to ask for this, or demand it, or even talk about it. It's my birthright as an American, goddammit, and anybody who fucks with my burger, who deviates from the time-honored bond that one has come to expect of one's burger vendor, that what one is eating is inarguably beef, not necessarily the best beef, mind you, but definitely recognizable as something that was, before grinding, mostly red, reasonably fresh, presumably from a steer or a cow, something that your average Doberman would find enticing. Anybody selling burgers that can't even conform to that not particularly high standard is, in my opinion, unpatriotic and un-American in the truest, most heartfelt sense of those words. If you are literally serving shit to American children, or knowingly spinning a wheel where it is not unlikely that you will eventually serve shit, if that's your business model, then I got no problems with a jury of your peers wiring your nuts to a car battery and feeding you the accumulated sweepings of the bottom of a monkey cage. In fact, I'll hold the spoon. In this way, me and the PETA folks and the vegetarians have something in common, an area of overlapping interests. They don't want us to eat any meat. I'm beginning to think, in light of recent accounts, that we should, on balance, eat a little less meat. PETA doesn't want stressed animals to be cruelly crowded into sheds, ankle-deep in their own crap, because they don't want any animals to die, ever, and basically think that chickens should, in time, gain the right to vote. I don't want animals stressed or crowded or treated cruelly or inhumanely, because that makes them provably less delicious, and often less safe to eat. Many people will tell you it is America's distorted relationship with what in grammar school we used to know as the food triangle, a hierarchy of food that always led up to meat, that's killing us slowly, clogging our airports and thoroughfares with the ever larger, ever slower moving morbidly obese, huffing and puffing their way to an early grave. That our exploding healthcare costs are increasingly attributable to what we eat and how much, rather than, say, cigarettes or even drugs. Which is fine, I guess, in a personal choice kind of way, if, as with heroin, you play and are then willing to pay. I like to think of myself as leaning towards libertarianism. I am very uncomfortable when the government says that it has to step in and make that most fundamental of decisions for us, what we should or shouldn't put in our mouths. In a perfect world, individuals would be free to take all the heroin they wanted and stuff their faces with trans fats as much as they like, until it becomes a problem for their neighbors, which it clearly has. Our insatiable lust for cheap meat is, in fact, fucking us up. Our distorted expectations of the daily meal are undermining the basic underpinnings of our society in ways large and small. That we're becoming a nation that, in the words of someone much smarter than I, is solely in the business of selling cheeseburgers to each other is pretty undeniable. If you add that we are, at even our most privileged end, in the business of lending money to people who sell cheeseburgers to each other. The cruelty and ugliness of the factory farm and the effects on our environment are, of course, repellent to any reasonable person. But it's the general lowering of standards inherent in our continuing insistence on cheap burgers, wherever they might come from and however bad they taste, the collective post-ironic shrug we've come to give each other as we knowingly dig into something that tastes, at best, like cardboard and soured onion, that's hurting us. In the America not ruled by the imperative to buy and sell cheap ground meat, however, something has been happening to my beloved hamburger, something about which I have mixed emotions. The slow, creeping influence of the boutique burger, the designer burger. Years ago, so many now that few of us even remember, there was a time when most Americans had similar expectations of coffee as they have traditionally had of the hamburger. That a decent, cheap, but not necessarily great cup of coffee in a cardboard container or heavy Buffalo China receptacle was a birthright. Coffee, it was generally accepted, did and should cost about 50 cents to a dollar, often with unlimited refills. Then Starbucks came along, whose particular genius was not the dissemination of such concepts as latte, half-calf, and mochaccino, or new terms for sizes like venti, nor did their brilliance lie in the particularly good quality of their coffee. Starbucks' truly beautiful idea was the simple realization that Americans wanted to spend more money for a cup of coffee, that they'd feel much better about themselves if they spent $5 for a cup of joe rather than buy that cheap drip stuff that shows such as friends suggested only fat white trash and housecoats or people who actually worked for a living drank anymore, in their trailer parks or meth labs or wherever such people huddled for comfort. And America wanted to drink its coffee, or more accurately, linger over it, in places that looked very much like Starbucks, where young, attractive people, like the cast of Friends, sipped their coffees and spent their time and no doubt engaged in witty banter between cranberry muffins, to a faint soundtrack featuring the non-threatening musical stylings of Natalie Merchant, for $5 a pop. A while ago, the guy behind the counter, and he sure as shit wasn't called a barista, asked you for $5 for a cup of coffee, any coffee, he'd better expect an argument, at least. Now, you wouldn't blink. The entire valuation of coffee has changed while we weren't looking. This, I suspect, is what's already happened and will continue to happen with the hamburger. The fashion industry figured this out long ago. Relatively few people could afford a Gucci suit, but they could surely afford a t-shirt with Gucci printed on it. What's happening is that 5 years from now, all those people who could never afford to eat at, say, Kraft, will surely be able to buy a Tom Colicchio burger. And I'm guessing, by the way, that unlike a Chinese-made t-shirt with a logo on it, it'll be a pretty good burger. Things keep going the way they're going, and the good burger, the designer burger, the one you'd entrust your child to, the one you want your friends to see you eating, that'll be $24, please. You'd think the major meat packers should have seen this coming. Should have seen that saving 30 cents a pound is all fine and good, but not when a few years down the line you risk losing the market. A few more E. coli outbreaks in fast food outlets or school systems, and you're likely to see a tail off. Few parents are going to let their little Ambers or Tiffany's eat the stuff that they're talking about on CNN all the time, next to pictures of dead children and diseased animals. It's really only a matter of time until, through a combination of successful demonization, genuine health concerns, and changing eating habits, America will actually start eating fewer of those gray discs of alleged meat. If recent history has taught us anything, though, it's that big food is way ahead of us with their market research. In all likelihood, when and if America sours on the generic burger, they'll be waiting for us on the other end with open arms. As incisively pointed out in the documentary Food Incorporated, an overwhelmingly large percentage of new, healthy, and organic alternative food products are actually owned by the same parent companies that scared us into the organic aisle in the first place. They got you coming and going has never been truer. Like breaking a guy's leg so you can be there to sell him a crutch. We're here for you when you get sick of or too frightened of our other product. Of course, it'll cost a little more, but then you expected that. Maybe an early warning sign, the beginning of a major shift in attitude came not from health concerns or rising awareness or the success of such excellent books as Fast Food Nation and The Omnivore's Dilemma, but from whatever devious and cynical chef first came up with the concept of the Kobe burger. He or she can hardly be blamed. The times when this seminal event occurred were surely ripe for it. New York City restaurants were clogged with loud, pinstriped, yet-to-be-indicted fucknuts hedge funders who relished the opportunity to showily throw $100 at a burger. Kobe, after all, was the best beef in the world, wasn't it? It came from, like, Japan, from, like, special cows who get massaged and beer and shit, don't they? I hear they even jack them off. This was the story going around anyway, as high-fiving day traders from some by-now-defunct investment bank or brokerage house hurried, lemming-like, to order the best burger ever. Of course, chances are the Kobe beef and that Kobe beef burger had never been anywhere near Japan. It was a distant relative at best, and even if the sublimely fatty product of pampered Wagyu cattle was used in the burger, it would have been, and remains, an utterly pointless, supremely wasteful, and even unpleasant exercise. What makes a Wagyu steak so desirable is the unbelievably prodigious marbling of fat that runs through it, often as much as 50%. Its resulting tenderness and richness and the subtle, repeat, subtle flavor. When grinding a hamburger, you can put in as much fat as you like. Just reach in the fat can and drop it in the machine. So there's no reason to pay $100 for a burger. A burger, presumably, already is about as tender as a piece of meat can be, and a taste as subtle as real Wagyu's would in any case be lost were you to do something so insensitive as bury it between two buns and slather it with ketchup. A 6-ounce tataki of real Wagyu steak, seared rare and sliced thinly, is about all you want or can eat in a sitting. It's that rich. It'll flood your head with so much fat you'll quickly reach a point of diminishing returns. Even an 8-ounce Kobe burger made from real Wagyu would be an exercise in futility and pretty disgusting. But no. The cream of big city douchedom ordered these things in droves, bragging about it all the way. It quickly became clear to chefs and restaurateurs that there was a huge, previously untapped market out there for expensive hamburgers, that customers at a certain income level clearly were willing, even eager, to pay more. All you had to do was put a brand name next to the word hamburger, and you could add value. That brand could be the name of a famous chef, many of whom wisely began to flock to the concept, or the name of a boutique producer, something that, like the word Kobe, implied specially raised, artisanal, humanely treated, organic, or sexually satisfied cattle. Chefs added extras like foie gras, truffles, braised oxtail, the exotic cheeses of many lands. Restaurateur Jeffrey Chatterer's New York restaurant Kobe Club, a name that implied an establishment where sophisticated gentlemen of the world could gather, mingle with others in the know, share meat-related experience with like-minded movers and shakers, was meant to be the apotheosis of this concept. But Chatterer was a little late to the party. New Yorkers had moved on. Instinctively suspicious of designer labels as potentially being something they might like in New Jersey, and uneasy with the crassness of the whole Kobe Club concept, New York foodies looked elsewhere for a prestige patty. Perhaps Kobe suffered from its association with Chatterer, a man whom food writers find an irresistible target. It's almost obligatory for food bloggers to mock his latest ventures, often before they're even open for business. Sneering at Chatterer is like making a mean crack about film director Brett Ratner if you're a budding film critic. It immediately asserts one's bona fides as a serious observer. Chatterer, like Ratner, seems only too happy to oblige. See such absurd, bizarro pastiches of restaurants past as Rocco's, the reality show-driven abomination, Caviar and Banana, a vaguely Brazilian follow-up, English is Italian, he isn't, by the way, and his latest, a jumbo-size attempt to straddle the Asian fusion, sushi, and izakaya markets. Even veteran food critics can't resist giving him a kick whenever the opportunity presents itself. The jokes write themselves. In post-Kobe New York, a new way to pay more for a burger was needed, and smearing foie gras or house-made relish on it was not going to be enough. A return to purist notions of the hamburger began to take hold, even an orthodoxy, in such forums where these things are earnestly considered and discussed. A virtuous burger, it was argued by aficionados, was the original recipe, a roots burger unsullied by foreign or modern flavors, one whose meaty charm spoke for itself. Said burger should come from the very best mix of the very best parts of the very best quality beef from animals of verifiably excellent breeding. And it should be cooked right, whatever that implied. Enter New York's Minetta Tavern, where the Black Label burger is of an exclusive blend prepared by Pat LaFrieda from grass-fed, free-range, organically raised Creekstone Farms beef, seared simply and unapologetically on a griddle where we are assured God intended us to cook our burgers, and served on a bun with a little onion confit, a slice of tomato, and a leaf of lettuce. Everything new is old again. Only it's $26 now. This is indeed one king hell motherfucker of a burger, one that would be seriously difficult to top in a blind taste-off of experts. Arguably, it's worth the bucks, if you have that kind of money. And face it, if you're eating at the Minetta Tavern, you probably do. But the speed with which accomplished and forward-thinking high-end chefs like Laurent Tourandel, Daniel Ballou, Tom Colicchio, Hubert Keller, Bobby Flay, and even Emeril made their moves to exploit the new frontiers of the hamburger concept has been breathtaking. And all of them, let it be pointed out, indeed serve a damn good burger. It's already the next big thing, and is likely to stay the big thing for the conceivable future. If anything, it's only the beginning. A trend that fits perfectly with the times, a relatively affordable, still luxury item, for a difficult economic environment, something that plays neatly into the national mood, the desire for comforting, reassuring food, the backlash against fancy, silly, or hoity-toity sounding dishes, a growing sense of discomfort with the traditional food supply, and the reverse snobbery of foodie elites who enjoy nothing more than arguing over what might be the most authentic version of quotidian classics. What of the burger of lore? The adequate, presumably safe, we thought so anyway, utility burger, draped and leaking clear grease across the bottom of an open bun, accompanied by an unripe tomato slice, a drying onion slice, and a leaf of iceberg that no one will ever eat, a limp wedge of obligatory dill pickle, a single slice of Kraft cheese food, half-melted and congealing even now, kitty-corner across the top. Will it disappear like the vivid, brightly colored Americana on Howard Johnson's menus past? The ham steaks checkerboarded with grill marks and garnished with pineapple rings, and the thick-crusted chicken pot pies of earlier decades? Will more assurances be necessary to future customers before slightly more expensive patties can be sold? Now serving our Chaste Quaker Farms mélange of grain-fed Angus beef, minimally dosed with antibiotics, and made only slightly uncomfortable during its final days in a dark, shit-smeared shed. Or will the default quality burger, the classic mystery meat patty, continue to survive and flourish indefinitely? Simply more expensive by $2 or so. Surely the message for the Greek couple at the luncheonette down the road, sizzling up the same frozen patties on a Mel-Fry smeared griddle like they always have, is that for some reason or another, the asshats down the street are paying $18 for a burger. We could definitely get away with jacking up our price by a dollar or two. Maybe this whole burger thing is part of a larger shift, where all the everyday foods of everyday Americans are being slowly, one after the other, co-opted, upgraded, reinvented, and finally, marked up. Look around. In the hottest restaurants of New York, San Francisco, and Chicago, it's the rich who are lining up to eagerly pay top dollar for the hooves, snouts, shanks, and tripe the poor used to have to eat. You'd have to go to Mario Batali and slap down $20 to find an order of chitterlings these days. You can look far and wide in Harlem without finding pig's feet, but Daniel Ballou has them on the menu. Regular pizza may be on the endangered list, artisanal pizza having already ghettoized the utility slice. Even the cupcake has become a boutique item, and the humble sausage is now the hottest single food item in New York City. Order a Heineken in Portland or San Francisco or just about anywhere these days, and be prepared to be sneered at by some locavore beer nerd, all too happy to tell you about some hoppy, malty, micro-brewed concoction redolent of strawberries and patchouli that they're making in a cellar nearby. Unless, of course, you opt for post-ironic retro, in which case that silo of PBR will come with a cover charge and an asphyxiating miasma of hipness. David Chang sells cereal milk by the gallon, an infusion, as I understand it, of the metabolized essence of cereal, the extracted flavors of Captain Crunch with crunchberries, perhaps, the sweet, vaguely pinkish milk left in the bottom of the bowl after you've drunkenly spooned and chawed your way through the solids. Maybe this is the high water mark of the phenomenon. And then again, maybe not. When and if the good guys win, will we, after terrifying consumers about our food supply, fetishizing expensive ingredients, exploiting the hopes, aspirations, and insecurities of the middle class, have simply made it more expensive to eat the same old crap? More to the point, have I? Am I helping, once again, to kill the things I love? Chapter 10. Lower Education. My wife and I are speaking in hushed tones directly outside our daughter's bedroom door, where we're sure she's pretending to be asleep. "Shh, she can hear us," says my wife, with a theatricality intended to sound conspiratorial. "No, she's asleep," I hiss, a little too loudly. A stage whisper. We're talking about Ronald McDonald again, bringing up the possibility of his being implicated in the disappearance of yet another small child. "Not another one," gasps my wife with feigned incredulity. "I'm afraid so," I say with concern. "Stepped inside to get some fries and a Happy Meal, and hasn't been seen since." "Are they searching for her?" "Oh, yes, they're combing the woods. Checked out the Hamburglar's place. But, of course, they're focusing on Ronald again." "Why Ronald?" "Well, last time, when they finally found that other one, what was his name, little Timmy? The police found evidence on the body. They found cooties." This is just one act in an ongoing dramatic production, one small part of a larger campaign of psychological warfare. The target, a 2.5-year-old girl. The stakes are high. As I see it, nothing less than the heart, mind, soul, and physical health of my adored only child. I am determined that the evil empire not have her, and to that end, I am prepared to use what Malcolm X called any means necessary. McDonald's have been very shrewd about kids. Say what you will about Ronald and friends, they know their market and who drives it. They haven't shrunk from targeting young minds. In fact, their entire gazillion-dollar promotional budget seems aimed squarely at toddlers. They know that one small child crying in the backseat of a car of two overworked, overstressed parents will, more often than not, determine the choice of restaurants. They know exactly when and how to start building brand identification and brand loyalty with brightly colored clowns and smoothly tied-in toys. They know that little Timmy will, with care and patience and the right exposure to brightly colored objects, grow up to be a full-size consumer of multiple Big Macs. It's why Ronald McDonald is said to be more recognizable to children everywhere than Mickey Mouse or Jesus. Personally, I don't care if my little girl ever recognizes those two other guys, but I do care about her relationship with Ronald. I want her to see American fast food culture as I do, as the enemy. From funding impoverished school districts to the shrewd installment of playgrounds, McDonald's has not shrunk from fucking with young minds in any way they can. They're smart, and I would not take that right to propagandize, advertise, whatever from them. If it's okay for Disney to insinuate itself into young lives everywhere, it should be okay for Ronald. I see no comfortable rationale for attacking them in the courts. They are, in any case, too powerful. Where you take on the clown and the king and the colonel is in the streets, or more accurately, in the same impressionable young minds they have so successfully fucked with for so long. My intention is to fuck with them right back. It's shockingly easy. Eric Schlosser's earnest call to arms Fast Food Nation may have had the facts on its side, but that's no way to wean a three-year-old off Happy Meals, much less hold her attention. The clown, the king, the colonel, and all their candy-colored high-fructose friends are formidable foes. And if the history of conflict has taught us anything, it's that one seldom wins a battle by taking the high road. This is not a debate that will be won on the facts. Kids don't give a shit about calorie count or factory farming or the impact that America's insatiable desire for cheap ground meat may have on the environment or our society's health. But cooties, they understand. What's the most frightening thing to a child? The pain of being the outsider, of looking ridiculous to others, of being teased or picked on in school. Every child burns with fear at the prospect. It's a primal instinct to belong. McDonald's has surely figured this out, along with what specific colors appeal to small children, what textures and what movies or TV shows are likely to attract them to the gray discs of meat. They feel no compunction harnessing the fears and unarticulated yearnings of small children, and nor shall I. Ronald has cooties, I say, every time he shows up on television or out the window of the car. And you know, I add, lowering my voice, he smells bad, too. Kind of like poo. I am, I should say, careful to use the word alleged each and every time I make such an assertion, mindful that my urgent whisperings to a two-year-old might be wrongfully construed as libelous. If you hug Ronald, can you get cooties? Asked my girl, a look of wide-eyed horror on her face. Some say yes, I reply, not wanting to lie, just in case she should encounter the man at a child's birthday party someday. It's a lawyerly answer, but effective. Some people talk about the smell, too. I'm not saying it rubs off on you or anything if you get too close to him, but I let that hang in the air for a while. Ooh, says my daughter. We sit in silence as she considers this, and then she asks, is it true that if you eat a hamburger at McDonald's, it can make you a retard? I laugh wholeheartedly at this one and give her a hug. I kiss her on the forehead reassuringly. Ha ha ha, I don't know where you get these ideas. I may or may not have planted that little nugget a few weeks ago, allowing her little friend Tiffany at ballet class to overhear it as I pretended to talk on my cell phone. I've been tracking this bit of misinformation like a barium meal as it worked its way through the kiddie underground, waiting and waiting for it to come out the other side, and it's finally popping up now. Bingo! The CIA calls this kind of thing black propaganda, and it's a sensible, cost-effective countermeasure, I believe, to the overwhelming superiority of the forces aligned against us. I vividly recall a rumor about rat hairs and chunky candies when I was a kid. It swept across schoolyards nationwide, this in pre-internet days, and had, as I remember it, a terrible effect on the company's sales. I don't know where the rumor started, and it was proven to be untrue. I'm not suggesting anybody do anything so morally wrong and unquestionably illegal. I'm just saying. Posting calorie information is, according to a recent New York Times article, not working. America's thighs get ever wider. Type 2 diabetes is becoming alarmingly common among children. It is repugnant in principle to me the suggestion that we legislate against fast food. We will surely have crossed some kind of terrible line if we as a nation are infantilized to the extent that the government has to step in and take the Whoppers right out of our hands. It is dismaying and probably inevitable. When we reach the point that we're unable to raise a military force of physically fit specimens, or public safety becomes an issue after some lurid example of a large person blocking a fire exit, they surely shall. A fat tax is probably on the horizon as well, an idea that worked with cigarettes. First, they tax cigarettes to the point of cruelty. Then they push smokers out of their workspaces, restaurants, bars, even in some cases their homes. After being penalized, demonized, marginalized, herded like animals into the cold, many, like me, finally quit. I don't want my daughter treated like that. I say, why wait? I don't think it's right or appropriate that we raise little girls in a world where freakishly tiny anorexic actresses and bizarrely lanky, unhealthily thin models are presented as ideals of feminine beauty. No one should ever feel pressured to conform to that image. But neither do I think it's okay to be unhealthily overweight. It is not an alternative lifestyle choice or choice of body image if you need help to get out of your car. I think constantly about ways to help my daughter in her food choices without bringing the usual pressures to bear. Look how nice and thin that Miley Cyrus is are not words that shall leave my lips, as such notions might drive a young girl to bulimia, bad boyfriends, and eventually crystal meth. So when I read of a recent study that found that children are significantly more inclined to eat difficult foods like liver, spinach, broccoli, and other such hard-to-sell but it's-good-for-you classics, when they are wrapped in comfortingly bright packages from McDonald's, I was at first appalled and then inspired. Rather than trying to co-opt Ronald's all-too-effective credibility among children to short-term positive ends like getting my daughter to eat the occasional serving of spinach, I could reverse-engineer this. Use the strange and terrible powers of the Golden Arches for good, not evil. I plan to dip something decidedly unpleasant in an enticing chocolate coating and then wrap it carefully in McDonald's wrapping paper. Nothing dangerous, mind you, but something that a 2.5-year-old will find yucky, even upsetting, in the extreme. Maybe a sponge soaked with vinegar, a tuft of hair, a Barbie head. I will then place it inside the familiar cardboard box and leave it, as if forgotten, somewhere for my daughter to find. I might even warn her. If you see any of that nasty McDonald's, make sure you don't eat it, I'll say, before leaving her to it. Daddy was stupid and got some chocolate, and now he's lost it, I might mutter audibly to myself before taking a long stroll to the laundry room. An early, traumatic, Ronald-related experience can only be good for her. Chapter 11. I'm dancing. The twist, actually, or something very much like it. And though I'm mortified by the very thought of dancing in front of witnesses, I am not alone in this room. Around me, 9 or 10 Filipina nannies and their charges are also swiveling their hips and moving to the music in their stocking feet. My dance partner is a 2-year-old girl in pink tights and a tutu. The red stuff beneath my fingernails is, I suspect, vestigial Play-Doh. This, I am fully aware, is not cool. This is as far away from cool as a man can get, but I am in no way troubled by such thoughts. I crossed that line a long time ago. If anything, I'm feeling pretty good about myself, in the smug, Upper East Side, bugaboo-owning, sidewalk-hogging, self-righteous kind of a way, indigenous to my new tribe. I am, after all, the only parent here on this fine Tuesday afternoon, alone among the gyrating nannies, the little Sophias, Vanessas, Julias, Emmas, and Isabellas. My daughter, grinning maniacally as she jumps and twists about 3 feet below me, is very pleased that I am here. That's right, I do love you more than the mothers of all these other children love them. That's why Daddy's here, and they're not. They're getting their fucking nails done, having affairs, going to Pilates class, or whatever bad parents do. I'm here for you, Boo, twisting my heart out, something I would never, ever have done for any other person in my whole life. Only for you. I'm a good daddy. Good daddy. Later, if she's good, there will be ice cream. I will seat her prominently next to me, facing the street in her petit bateau jumper, secretly hoping that passers-by will notice how beautiful she is, how cute we are together, what a great dad I am. Holding her little hand, or carrying her on my shoulders, I will float home on a cloud of self-congratulation. I'm through being cool. Or more accurately, I'm through entertaining the notion that anybody could even consider the possibility of coolness emanating from or residing anywhere near me. As any conscientious father knows in his bones, any remaining trace elements of coolness go right out the window from the second you lay eyes on your firstborn. The second you lean in for the action, see your baby's head make that first quarter corkscrew turn toward you, well, you know you can and should throw your cherished black leather motorcycle jacket right in the nearest trash bin. Clock's ticking on the earring, too. It's somehow undignified now. Norman Mailer described the desire to be cool as a, quote, decision to encourage the psychopath in oneself, to explore that domain of experience where security is boredom and therefore sickness, and one exists in the present, in that enormous present, which is without past or future, memory, or planned intention, unquote. I encouraged the psychopath in myself for most of my life. In fact, that's a rather elegant description of whatever it was I was doing. But I figure I put in my time. The essence of cool, after all, is not giving a fuck. And let's face it, I most definitely give a fuck now. I give a huge fuck, the hugest. Everything else, everything pales. To pretend otherwise by word or deed would be a monstrous lie. There will be no more Dead Boys t-shirts. Whom would I be kidding? Their charmingly nihilistic worldview in no way mirrors my own. If Stiv Bators were still alive and put his filthy hands anywhere near my baby, I'd snap his neck, then thoroughly cleanse the area with baby wipes. There is no hope of hipness. As my friend A.A. Gill points out, after your daughter reaches a certain age, like 5, the most excruciating and embarrassing thing she could possibly imagine is seeing her dad in any way threatening to rock. Your record collection may indeed be cooler than your daughter's will ever be, but this is a meaningless distinction now. She doesn't care, and nobody else will. If you're lucky, long after you're gone, a grandchild will rediscover your old copy of Funhouse, but it will be way too late for you to bask in the glory of past coolness. There is nothing cool about used to be cool. All of this, I think, is only right and appropriate. Too much respect for your elders is historically almost always a bad thing. I want my daughter to love me. I don't necessarily want her to share my taste for Irish ale or Hawaiian Bud. When you see the children of the perennially cool on shows like Behind the Music, they look sheepish and slightly doomed, talking about their still-working rock and roller dads as if they're the reluctant warders of some strange breed of extravagantly wrinkly and badly behaved children. Kids may not be old enough to know what cool is, but they are unerring in their ability to sense what isn't. No kid really wants a cool parent. Cool parents, when I was a kid, meant parents who let you smoke weed in the house or allowed boyfriends to sleep over with their daughters. That would make Sarah Palin cool. But as I remember, we thought those parents were kind of creepy. They were useful, sure, but what was wrong with them that they found us so entertaining? Didn't they have their own friends? Secretly, we hated them. Turning 30 came as a cruel surprise for me. I hadn't really planned on making it that far. I'd taken seriously the maxims of my time, never trust anyone over 30 and live fast, die young, and been frankly shocked when I found that I'd lived that long. I'd done everything I could think of to ensure the opposite result, but there I was, and without a plan B. The restaurant business provided a degree of stability in that there were usually people who expected me to get up in the morning and go somewhere, and heroin, if nothing else, was useful in giving me a sense of purpose in my daily movements. I knew what I had to do every day for most of my early 30s. Get heroin. Of my first marriage, I'll say only that watching Gus Van Sant's Drugstore Cowboy, particularly the relationship between Matt Dillon's Bob and Kelly Lynch's Diane, inspires feelings of great softness and sentiment in me. It's a reminder that even the worst times can be happy ones, until they aren't. By my late 30s, I found that I was still lingering, and I admit to a sense of disappointment, confusion, even defeat. What do I do now? I remember thinking. Detoxed from heroin and methadone, and having finally ended a lifelong love affair with cocaine, where was my reward for all this self-denial? Shouldn't I have been feeling good? If anything, all that relative sobriety pointed up a basic emptiness and dissatisfaction in my life, a hole I'd managed to fill with various chemicals for the better part of 25 years. At 44, shortly after writing Kitchen Confidential, I found myself suddenly with a whole new life. One minute I was standing next to a deep fryer pan-searing pepper steaks, and the next I was sitting on top of a dune watching the sunset over the Sahara. I was running roadblocks in Battambang. Tiny feet were walking on my back in Siem Reap. I was eating at El Bulli. Shortly before the breakup of my first marriage, I embarked on the equivalent of a massive public works project in my apartment. New shelves, furniture, carpets, appliances, all the trappings I thought of a normal and happy life, the kind of things I'd never really had or lived around since childhood. I wrote a crime novel around that time in which the character's yearnings for a white picket fence kind of a life reflect my own far more truthfully than any nonfiction I've ever written. Shortly after that, I cruelly burned down my previous life in its entirety. There was a period of readjustment. I recall the precise second when I decided that I wanted to, that I was going to be, a father. Wanting a child is easy enough. I'd always, even in the bad old days, thought fondly of the times my father would carry me aloft on his shoulders into the waves off the Jersey shore, saying, "Here comes a big one." I'd remembered my own 5-year-old squeals of terror and delight and thought, I'd like to do that with a child someday, see that look on my own child's face. But I knew well that I was the sort of person who shouldn't and couldn't be a daddy. Kids like me fine, my niece and nephew, for instance, but it's easy to make kids like you, especially when you're the indulgent, evil uncle. I'd never lived in an environment where a child would have been a healthy fit, and I'd never felt like I was a suitably healthy person. I'd think of fatherhood from time to time, look at myself in the mirror, and think, that guy may want a child. He's simply not up to the job. And well, for most of my life, I've been way too far up my own ass to be of use to anyone, something that only got worse after Kitchen Confidential. I don't know exactly when the possibility of that changing presented itself, but sometime, I guess, after having made every mistake, having already fucked up in every way a man can fuck up, having realized that I'd had enough cocaine, that no amount in the world was going to make me any happier, that a naked, oiled supermodel was not going to make everything better in my life, nor any sports car known to man. It was sometime after that. The precise moment of realization came in my tiny fourth-floor walk-up apartment on 9th Avenue, above Manganaro's Hero Boy restaurant, next building over from Esposito Pork Shop. I was lying in bed with my then-girlfriend, I guess you could diplomatically call it spooning, and I caught myself thinking, I could make a baby with this woman. I'd like to make a baby with this woman. Fuck, I'd not only be happy to make a baby with this woman, I think, I'm pretty sure, I'd actually be good at it. We discussed this, and Otavia, that was, is her name, also thought this was a fine idea, though of my prospects for a quick insemination, she was less optimistic. Baby, she said, insert a very charming Italian accent with the tone and delivery of a busy restaurant manager, you're old. Your sperm is dead. Assuming a long campaign, we planned to get at it as soon as I returned from shooting my next show in Beirut. Of that episode, I've written elsewhere. Long and short of it, my camera crew and I were caught in a war. For about a week, we holed up in a hotel, watching and listening to the bombs, feeling their impact rolling through the floors. After some drama, we were evacuated from a beach on a landing craft units by American Navy and Marine personnel, and taken first to a cargo vessel in the Med, and then on to Cyprus. My network had very generously provided a private jet to take me and the crew back home. None of my crew had ever been on a private jet before, and we slept and played cards and ate omelets prepared by the flight attendant, finally landing on a rainy gray morning in Teterboro, New Jersey. We walked across the tarmac to a small private terminal where Pat Young, the president of the network, and Otavia, as well as the crew's wives and family, were there to meet us. It was, to say the least, an emotional homecoming with much hugging and crying. I took Otavia back to my crummy apartment, and we made a baby. Nothing like 8 days of fear and desperation to concentrate the mind, I guess. A few weeks later, we were in a car on the way from LAX into Los Angeles, where I was about to appear as judge on Top Chef, when we got the news from Otavia's doctor over the phone. There are photos of me sitting on a bed in the Chateau Marmont, holding 5 different brands of drugstore pregnancy tests, all of them positive, a giddily idiotic grin on my face. Strangely, perhaps, I had no fear. At no time then or since did I have second thoughts. What am I getting into never flashed across my brain. I was the star pupil at Lamaze class. If your water ever breaks at the supermarket and I'm nearby, I'm your boy. I know just what to do. I look back on my less well-behaved days with few regrets. True, the responsibilities of marriage and fatherhood demand certain behavioral adjustments, but my timing couldn't have been better. I find myself morphing, however awkwardly, into respectability just as things are getting really hot on the streets for any of my peers who are even semi-recognizable. The iniquitousness of Twitter and food and chef-related websites and blogs has totally changed the game for anyone with a television show, even me. You don't have to be very famous at all these days to end up with a blurry photograph on dumbasscelebrities.com. You don't want your daughter's little schoolmates reading about her daddy stuttering drunk 2 o'clock in the morning at a chef-friendly bar doing belly shots from a chunky and underdressed cocktail waitress, something that could well have happened a few years ago. In a day when a passing cell phone user can easily get a surreptitious photo of you slinking out of the porn shop with copies of Anal Rampage 2 and MILF Busters under your arm and post it in real time, maybe that's a particularly good time to trade in the leather jacket for some cotton Dockers. I love the saying, nobody likes a dirty old man or a clean little boy. I was unfortunately overly clean as a child, the fruit of a fastidious household. I shall try and make up for those years by doing my best to avoid becoming the former. Like I said, my timing, even without the daddyhood thing, was good. It's all about the little girl. Because I am acutely aware of both her littleness, how could I be otherwise, and the fact that she's a blank page, her brain a soft surface waiting for the irreversible impressions of every raised voice, every gaffe, and unguarded moment. The fact that she's a girl requires, I believe, extra effort. Data may have at various times in his life been a pig, but Data surely does not want to ever look like a pig again. This can't possibly be overstated. As the first of 2 boys, I can't even imagine what it must be like for a little girl to see her dad leering at another of her sex. This creature will soon grow up to be a young woman, and that's something I consider every day. I figure I'm going to spoil the shit out of this kid for a while and pack her off to Taekwondo as soon as she's 4 years old. Her first day of second grade and little Timmy at the desk behind her tries to pull her hair, he's getting an elbow to the thorax. My little girl may grow up with lots of problems. Spoiled, with unrealistic expectations of the world, cultural identification confusion perhaps, a product of much traveling in her early years. Considering the food she's exposed to, she shall surely have a jaded palate and an aged and possibly infirm dad by the time she's 16. But she ain't gonna have any problems with self-esteem. Whatever else, she's never going to look for validation from some predatory asshole. She can, and surely will, hang out with tons of assholes. Dads, I'm assured, can never hope to control that. All I can hope for is that she hangs out with assholes for her own reasons, that she's genuinely amused by assholes, rather than needing them to make her feel better about herself. I wish. John F. Kennedy said something truly terrifying. Guaranteed to make every parent's blood run cold. To have a child is to give fate a hostage. Something I wish I'd never read. I can only hope she's happy. Even weird and happy will suit me just fine. She will feel loved. She'll have food and shelter, a large Italian and Sardinian family and a smaller American one. She'll have seen by the time she's 6 years old much of the world, and she'll have seen as well that not everybody on this planet lives or can live anything like the way she lives. She will hopefully have spent time playing and running barefoot with the children of fishermen and farmers in rural Vietnam. She will have swum in every ocean. She will know how to use chopsticks and what real cheese is. She already speaks more Italian than I do. Beyond this, I don't know what else I can do.